From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters. In the aftermath of an attempted coup and the storming and looting of the nation's capital, can the 25th Amendment save America? This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. On January 6th, a mob of pro-Trump, anti-democracy, conspiracy theorists, Holocaust deniers, white supremacists, and homegrown terrorists stormed the U.S. Capitol, threatened the lives of members of Congress, senators, and Capitol staff. One Capitol police officer was murdered in the siege. This seditious attack on the American government was incited and cheered on by President Donald Trump, as well as Texas Senator Ted Cruz and Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton. Trump's time as president is running out, but because of this Trump-sponsored coup attempt, January 20th can't come soon enough for many. A growing number of elected officials are calling for invoking the 25th Amendment or snap impeachment to remove the president from office before the next coup attempt. How would that work? John Hudak is the deputy director of the Centers for Effective Public Management and senior fellow of governance studies at the Brookings Institution.
So Section 4 of the 25th Amendment sets up a process by which either the vice president and a majority of the cabinet or a commission created by Congress declares the president incapacitated, that is, essentially unfit to serve in office. And once that process goes into place, the powers of the presidency transfer to the vice president, who serves as acting president.
It was an amendment pretty late in the Constitution, looking at the number 25th. How did we get this thing?
25th Amendment was ratified by the states in the late 1960s. And the reason for it really was an understanding that prior to that, if the president were stricken by some disease still alive but unable to, resign, it created a constitutional crisis. So imagine a scenario in which a president has a stroke and is left in a coma. He's still breathing. He's still alive. But he can't turn the powers of the office over. So a process was put into place to allow actors either in the executive branch or in the legislative branch to do that without impeachment and removal. Of course, that's not the only situation in which Section 4 of the 25th Amendment can be utilized, but that was sort of the basis for it, particularly after President Woodrow Wilson did suffer a pretty significant stroke during his term, and there were a lot of questions about his ability to serve during his recovery.
And we also had Garfield after his shooting, that he lingered for 80 days, and Eisenhower had heart attacks when he was in office. There were a lot of questions about the line of succession, and this basically just codified that.
That's right, and the same was true, too, with President Reagan when he was shot. The powers of the office were not temporarily transferred over, which a president can do voluntarily, and a few presidents have when they're undergoing medical procedures. But in the case of Reagan, he went into surgery without having invoked Section 3 of the 25th Amendment, which is when a president proactively does that. And the vice president and the cabinet didn't activate Section 4. And so for a period of time while President Reagan was in surgery, the United States did not have a president.
Well, some people are calling for the 25th Amendment to do now is really not what this thing is designed to do. When you look at the hurdles that have to be cleared in order to basically declare a president incompetent and remove him from office. I mean, can you talk about the process to explain how difficult that could be?
Sure. From the outset, I agree. This was not necessarily envisioned as a basis for invoking the 25th Amendment, although certainly the 25th Amendment can be invoked for whatever reasons the right actors want to invoke. I should also add, in 1967, I think it was also not fathomable that a president would incite people to take up arms against the United States either. The process by which Section 4 plays out is that either the vice president and a majority of the cabinet sign a letter to the Congress saying that the president is incapacitated, or the Congress creates some sort of commission or body to make that judgment. Once that judgment is made, again, either by the commission or by the vice president and a majority of the cabinet, the power transfers to the vice president immediately. The president can then notify the Congress that he is no longer incapacitated, which, if it were invoked in this situation, you could be certain President Trump would do that. Once that happens, the vice president and a majority of the cabinet or the commission created by Congress to do the same can once again notify the Congress that no, presidential incapacitation continues to be present, at which point Congress takes up that issue. Congress is supposed to convene within 48 hours to deal with that question, although there is a question about how long Congress can drag its feet in terms of debating the issue and coming to the conclusion. But both houses of Congress would need to sustain presidential incapacitation, that is, continue the vice president to hold the powers by a two-thirds vote in both chambers.
Don't they have 21 days to decide to have that vote?
Yeah, that's right. But within that period of time, there aren't really House rules that would suggest that the vote needs to be prioritized immediately, that the vote has to happen with a certain number of hours within the Congress. The Constitution does create a time limit, but it is a pretty broad time limit, which would allow for congressional foot dragging in the event of there not being enough of votes, or in the case we face right now, run out the clock on the Trump presidency.
So that's a critical component to keep this in mind. So it would be totally different because you wrote a couple of years ago about how the 25th Amendment is not going to be a solution to other problems that we had with Donald Trump. But now, because we're only days away from his term expiring, that it's a different sort of situation, which the strategy has changed.
I think that's right. And also, not only has the strategy changed given the time frame that we're looking at and the sort of scorched earth approach that the president appears to be taking in the final days of his term, but also the situation we're in where a president and his family members and his supporters incited violence against our government. That is a whole other ballgame than when the 25th Amendment conversations were coming up 2 or 3 years ago.
You laid out a couple of different scenarios. I'm trying to look at this practically and looking at the individuals that we have in place, Vice President Mike Pence and the cabinet members. We see the cabinets, you know, they're resigning. People are talking about this in realistic terms and they don't want to deal with it. And so they're heading for the hills.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's a few components here that are important to look at. One, I think there are some members of the cabinet and other members within the administration below the cabinet level who looked at the events of this week and are truly disgusted and are leaving out of principle. At the same time, there have been pretty strong signals from the vice president that he is not interested in invoking Section 4 of the 25th. Really, short of Congress creating a commission, the process cannot begin without the vice president. And so if that is the case, I think there are others in government who are looking at it and saying the safety valve that we have in this situation, the 25th Amendment, is not going to be invoked because the vice president is hesitant to do it. And so I'm leaving. I will not be part of this process. I would imagine there would be other officials in government who would much more likely serve for the last few days under an acting President Mike Pence than under an out-of-control President Trump.
That's why I brought up the George H.W. Bush problem with Reagan. I mean, even when Reagan had been shot, he didn't want to assume the role of the presidency. But now asking Pence to do it is even a bigger ask. You have to wonder if Mike Pence is looking at the rest of his political career.
In terms of Mike Pence and what he's thinking about, what George H.W. Bush was thinking about as vice president and their own political careers, Vice President Pence took an oath to this country. He didn't take an oath to a potential future presidential run. He didn't take an oath to his party. He is the vice president of the United States exactly for these situations, to make the right call and to do the right thing to protect the government, to protect the public, to protect the republic. And if his concerns about running for president in 2024 are restricting him from protecting the United States, I think that tells you a lot about his capability to become president one day.
Unfortunately, we're seeing some of our elected officials, their oath of office, they don't care. They're going to do what they're going to do.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And part of the reason why politicians like that will do whatever they want to do is because we don't hold them accountable, that there aren't consequences for those actions. And so I think in this situation, with the president inciting, a group of terrorists to take up arms against their own government, you really see when that behavior goes unpunished, it simply lays the groundwork for other misbehavior by this president and by future presidents, because they will then have the peace of mind that no matter what, the government processes that are in place to protect us against these situations will not be invoked.
Now, that brings up the other concern of other presidents down the road. Could the 25th Amendment, if it becomes part of our political landscape, it's been used and we know what it does, could it be abused in the future?
I think any constitutional process can be abused. What I will say is that there are protections in place for events like these to make sure that the 25th Amendment is very difficult to abuse. And so it begins first with the requirement that the vice president and a majority of the president's own cabinet begin this process. That, I think, is a very serious protection against abuse. When the vice president, who in almost any circumstance, is the individual handpicked by the president to be number two, and a group of cabinet members who the president has also handpicked for those roles, gets to a point where they believe that the president is incapacitated, whether it's because of his behaviors or whether it's because of the state of his health or because of both. So that's a pretty good safeguard in the first place. The second is, in order to sustain presidential incapacity, it requires a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress. We don't have a political landscape right now where one party would be able to control two-thirds of the House seats and two-thirds of the Senate seats. The country is just too polarized for that. And so that, too, suggests that if this were to be used for political purposes rather than protection purposes, that those barriers are so difficult and so challenging to overcome that it really limits the ability of this to be used as a political tool.
Make sure I got this correct. The way the 25th Amendment could work to involuntarily remove Donald Trump from the presidency under Section 4, Mike Pence by himself, he could send a letter to Congress?
No, Mike Pence would have to sign a letter along with a majority of the cabinet members.
But a majority of the cabinet members, what does that mean when you have cabinet members who are dropping off like Betsy DeVos and they're just fleeing? Does that mean you have fewer to majority of?
It creates an interesting question, actually, because the language of the Constitution is that a majority of the principal officers of the United States, which typically means cabinet secretaries. But the question is that there's effectively always a cabinet secretary, just in acting capacities. And so I think there is a question about whether acting cabinet members would be eligible to participate in this. My guess is in the moment of crisis, courts would tend to defer to the role that those individuals are serving as an acting cabinet member. But I do think it would raise a potential constitutional challenge about who is eligible to participate in the invocation of Section 4.
So this doesn't seem like that's something that's going to happen. These cabinet members, come on.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like this is likely to happen. You have some resignations happening, and in the case of Secretary Chao, the Secretary of Transportation, she has delayed her resignation from taking effect until Monday, which would suggest that if something were to happen over the next couple of days, she would be in place to participate. But it doesn't seem likely that the group that President Trump has assembled looks at the situation and is sufficiently appalled by it to, go through the constitutional process of protecting the government.
So where does that leave us?
It leaves us with a very difficult 12 days. President Trump will almost certainly retain the powers of the presidency, exercise those powers as he sees fit, hopefully decides to change his rhetoric and tone down what is happening among his supporters and their views on how their grievances can be redressed. But the reality is this. I don't think President Trump can put the toothpaste back in the tube. He's generated this anger. And when you look at what the response to his semi-concession speech on social media was yesterday, it was people essentially turning against Trump and saying, this is bigger than Trump, because he has incited in them this belief based entirely on a set of lies that the election was stolen from them. And he has gotten them rabid-mouthed over this, and him simply saying, go home, is not enough to make them go home.
A snap impeachment, could that do anything?
A snap impeachment, it seems like a very difficult situation. The House certainly could very quickly and efficiently vote out articles of impeachment, but there are processes in place through which a Senate trial needs to take place. And a Senate trial is not something that is going to happen instantly with a very quick vote. And so that process, the impeachment side, could certainly happen quickly, but the conviction side, which frankly, I don't think the votes are there to convict and remove the president. But if they were, that process would take us through almost certainly the end of the presidency.
Are there any other procedures that could be invoked to remove the president from the Oval Office, strip him of his powers? I mean, it seems to be an open question of whether or not a president can be arrested or not.
Yeah, there really are no other processes by which the president could have his powers removed from him, obviously short of resignation, but that would be on his own terms. I do think there could be informal processes that would effectively be illegal, whereby cabinet members, leadership in the military just refuse to carry out his orders, particularly in the military. Defying the chain of command is something that could be court-martialed, but that would probably be the only informal way to effectively neuter the president's power, and that is by simply refusing to do what the president says.
Do people say, you know, we've got just a few days. How much damage could he do, really?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly an open question, and if the answer to that question is a lot, I think most Americans don't want to find out the hard way.
We saw this mob of ne'er-do-wells storming the Capitol building. I mean, can you imagine what the reaction would be if there was someone who arrested Donald Trump over the next couple of days in order to keep him from doing something even worse?
Yeah, the reality of the idea of arrest is just not possible. So the entity that would really need to arrest someone like that would be a federal official. And there's a Department of Justice memo that says a president can't be indicted.
It's a memo.
While he's
it's a memo.
It's a memo, but it's also the memo that the people working at the Department of Justice abide by. And if they are the ones who would have to actually perform an arrest, their internal processes would not let them. It would also create a very difficult situation with the Secret Service in which a turf war would break out. And so the idea of arresting the president, A, just doesn't make sense. And B, we have other processes in place to deal with it. Now, if there's cowardice in the cabinet or in the Congress to deal with it in that way, that's very unfortunate. But I don't think the way to combat that type of cowardice is to engage in a process that is extra legal.
What do you think it says about where we are in America right now that you and I are having this conversation and this is a legitimate concern?
Yeah, you know, I think it's a dark period for our country's history. You know, this problem is not just Donald Trump. You have people like Josh Hawley and Ted Cruz and Kevin McCarthy and others in the Congress who were perfectly happy to go along with the idea of the president creating this case about election fraud based on zero evidence and for the Congress to throw out a presidential election, to disenfranchise hundreds of millions of voters. That's a real problem. And I think we focus a lot on Donald Trump because he's the president, because he is the leader of these types of actions, because he's the one firing up the base so much. But there needs to be a moment of national healing, but there also has to be a moment of national learning about the dangers of this type of political behavior. And once Donald Trump is gone, that will resolve the issues that we have with Donald Trump. But Josh Hawley is going to be a senator for at least another 4 years. Ted Cruz is going to be a senator for a while. These individuals are going to remain in the public sphere. And if they believe it is politically expedient to generate anger in the public and drive them to take up arms against their country, they're going to keep doing it. And so that's a real problem. And, you know, the one thing I've said, I tweeted it this week as well, that just as important, just as problematic as the people storming the Capitol building this week were the millions of people sitting at home applauding them. It is not just the people who stormed the Capitol who believe this ideology, who would take up arms against their own country. In some cases, while waving a Confederate flag, the symbol of taking up arms against the United States. But there are a lot of people sitting at home who would more than happily support that same cause.
We did have this week, in Georgia, two Senate elections where the Democrats won. You could make a really legitimate case that this is a losing strategy if you're trying to capture the votes of the majority of Americans.
I think any sane observer of American politics would say that the approach that the president has taken, the approach that Senator Hawley has taken, the approach that Senator Cruz has taken, is a losing effort. But they're also going to look at the political landscape and say there were a lot of Senate seats we were supposed to lose in 2020 that we didn't lose. We picked up a bunch of House seats in 2020. And if, you know, 45,000 votes switched in three states, Donald Trump would have been reelected. And on top of that, I think the terrorists who attacked my city and our government this week are going to look at what they did and think that was a success. They got in. They stole the speaker's gavel. They stole a podium. They murdered a police officer. They see that as a win. And so while it is a losing strategy, I think a lot of them will look at certain data points in certain behaviors and certain activities and pat themselves on the back and say they did a good job and be happy about their win.
So, like, we have Ted Cruz, Hawley, Tom Cotton, another senator from Arkansas, who seem to be positioning themselves to run for president in 2024, and they are looking to capture the Donald Trump base and run as a smarter, more sophisticated Donald Trump, which would be even more dangerous. So even if we get through now and January 20th, the American democracy is still in jeopardy, isn't it?
I think it is. You know, I think a more savvy, smarter, better prepared version of Donald Trump could cause some even greater havoc in this country. But what we need to remember is that the Republican Party is at a crossroads. They have a decision to make. Are they going to be the party espousing Donald Trump's views, encouraging sedition against the United States, encouraging terrorists to organize on websites like QAnon or with ideologies like QAnon and organize on social media platforms like Parler to take up arms against the United States? Or are they going to go back to their basics, which is a strong belief in national security, a strong belief in law and order, a strong belief in states' rights, lower taxes, less regulation? Are they going to be the party that they were in the 1970s and the 1980s? Or has Trump and that ideology of hate taken them over? And I think the 2024 presidential primary is going to be the referendum on where the Republican Party is. Will someone like Josh Hawley be the one who inherits a party based steeped in hate and racism? And for your listeners who that might be triggering for, it's important to remember some of the people who stormed the Capitol were carrying Confederate flags, who had anti-Semitic messages on their clothing, like one that said that they were a camp counselor at Camp Auschwitz. This is an ideology of hate and racism. And if Josh Hawley wants to be the recipient of that, he's doing a pretty good job to do it. But it's not necessary that the entire Republican Party be the victim and the recipient of that. There are plenty of people in the Republican Party in elected office who don't see eye to eye with President Trump. The question is whether voters will empower those people or whether they just want another rerun of what we've seen for the past 4 years.
Okay, but there are plenty of people who support Donald Trump and the Republican Party who reject the storming of the Capitol, but they want lower taxes and they want less regulation and they want stronger gun rights and they want to outlaw abortion. And those are the things that they want. And they are perfectly happy to go along with Donald Trump and his antics and the racism in order to achieve that. That's the coalition that is now the Republican Party. Has the price gotten too high for them? Are they finally going to say no more? I can't do this anymore.
I think that's the big question facing the Republican Party right now. Are conservative judges and tax cuts worth encouraging people to take up arms against their own government? There's an easy answer to that question, and there is a fundamentally right answer to that question. The real question is whether Republicans are going to make the right call on it, and we just don't know. Republicans have been successful in the past without empowering racists and terrorists. The question is whether they're going to be able to get back to doing that again.
Many people who ran into the Capitol building were shouting, along with like USA, they were shouting, "We want our country back." Their grievance is that democracy no longer works for them, that they no longer have the majority view. If democracy doesn't work for them, then democracy shouldn't exist in the United States anymore. What do you say to those people?
What I would say to them is that they're not supporting democracy. In democracy, there's winners and losers.
But they don't want to be losers. They were happy being the winners.
No, exactly. They don't like being losers. But the reality is, in politics, just like in a football game, there's winners and losers. And sometimes you're going to come out on the other end of those things. But to overthrow the government because you don't like the outcome of democracy is not a democratic act. And if they convince themselves that it is, they are wrong. They need to grow up. They need to understand how our system works and work better within it rather than trying to overthrow it. They are not successful because their ideas are not popular. The way to do that is to convince people that your ideas are the better ones. The worst way to possibly do that is to storm the Capitol building, murder a police officer, put at risk the lives of the House Speaker and the Vice President and the President Pro Tem of the Senate and the Vice President-elect, commit acts of sedition against the United States. That is not how you win Americans to your cause. That is how you lose them.
John Hudak is the Deputy Director at the Center for Effective Public Management and Senior Fellow of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page or on our website at tpr.org. That's where you'll find past Texas Matters episodes, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.